Yeah. So we are now in the middle of essay number 3 in 1 Corinthians. We'll be looking at chapter 10, verses 1 through 13, where Paul talks about partial identification. So we talked about food offered to idols, how that touches on the question of freedom and responsibility. Paul gave his personal story, personal example of how he has dealt with that issue. So he defends his apostolic authority and rights, but he refuses to use them. He refuses to exercise his rights. Partly so that no human being can have control over his actions, and partly so that he can demonstrate the free nature of the gospel. And then he talked about mission and how Christians need to identify fully with the people that they are ministering to. Now, it's not just serving other people is not enough for Paul. For Paul enters into the lives. He becomes a part of their community.
It's an essential part.
A true missionary.
Yeah, his key point there is become weak. No, not just serve the weak, but become weak. And the whole point about why he brings up the topic of athletics and discipline was that he wanted to make the point that that kind of incarnational mission of entering into the lives and communities of people demands great discipline.
It's not just become lax and do whatever you please because the rules have changed.
It's like arduously study so that you don't offend and that you can identify with people's needs and desires.
So that brings the essay to now the Old Covenant, sacraments, and idolatry. And Paul is going to discuss partial identification.
Didn't we end on something that's confused a lot of people? I'm trying to remember what.
About
24. Do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, but only one realizes the prize?
Oh, but what's the prize?
So
I think that was it.
Well,
the wreath,
imperishable wreath.
That I myself shall be disqualified, and I think you were trying to say that was. It wasn't that he's disqualified for salvation, he's disqualified for being able to serve as a mission.
Yes.
Well, being able to serve all different kinds of people. Not everyone is qualified to serve in that way. And that's a revolutionary understanding of that phrase. I never heard that described that way before, and that's pretty cool.
I'm not getting it yet.
What we said, what you tried to portray last week was get us off of our narrow viewpoint of salvation. Everybody's so worried about my personal salvation. And what Paul is saying is he is training, he's studying, he's learning so that he can meet other people's needs. And what he's going to be disqualified from is the ability to meet other people's needs.
Right.
Yeah. The salvation is not the prize he's talking about.
His salvation is not the prize.
Yeah.
The salvation of others is the prize.
We tend to assume that when he says that I might be disqualified, he's talking about his own salvation would be in jeopardy. But he might be unable to serve all those different kinds of people. It takes a certain kind of person to be qualified for that kind of service. And that's a totally different thing that we never heard before.
Yeah, we always put things into our human first thing. It's like, oh yeah, he's got to be saved, right? If he's not saved, how can he save somebody else? He's like, he doesn't give a rip about his salvation.
That's not the issue of faith.
That's not what salvation is.
Yeah, that's not the issue. He's not talking about that.
He's already sure of that.
Yeah.
He's not.
Yeah.
That's not.
He's not saying
on the table at all.
Oh, my salvation might be an issue if something. But he's saying that
he doesn't want to disqualify himself to serve others.
Right. He's talking about running the race and it's difficult and it takes a lot of work. And the prize at hand for success is the ability to do this kind of service, which most people can't.
So if you look at it from that perspective, then you go back to food offered to idols. He's not thinking about his salvation. He's thinking about his ability to reach other people's needs. Then it puts a different focus on it.
Uh-huh. And where I'm guessing that in that culture, that while it was cheaper food, I'm guessing that most of the people he's dealing with right there probably aren't in financial straits, that was that much of an issue.
The Corinthian church was composed of a mixture, those who were quite wealthy and those who were not.
Uh-huh.
And for the poor, the only times they would have access to meat is during the large pagan festivals, when large amounts of animals were sacrificed.
Uh-huh.
And that glutted the market.
Right.
And so prices
so
would
everybody
drop.
Everybody could get some.
Whereas the rich, you know, they could afford meat any time, whether it was sacrificed or not.
Yeah.
But for the poor, the perception was that meat was always something that was offered to idols first.
Right.
Because if it was affordable, it had been offered to idols. And so he's saying,
that's
just
why
don't
he
hurt
says,
anybody over it.
That's why he says, if I am with someone who has an issue with this, who will be hurt by it, I'll be vegetarian.
So it's a very, very, very poor parallel. But us wealthy Christians, we have to be concerned about our health. And we buy the best food that is organic.
Mm-hmm.
Where the poor get the junk food that's not organic, and we don't dare go to their house and eat because it's not organic. That would be a poor somewhat.
Maybe, sort of, yeah.
I can't go to your house. It's not organic.
Or even without bringing organic into the picture, we were raised Adventists. We are very familiar with
clean and unclean.
Yeah. Whose house you can eat at and are they going to be eating the right things, and is that okay for you to eat there?
You're not even supposed to eat fruits and your vegetables. You're not supposed to mix them. Duh.
Is it okay for them to eat it? Are you going to make jabs at them? My
dad,
unfortunately, were really good at that.
And when we were kids, we didn't even think of eating at somebody's house who wasn't Adventist. That wasn't one of the options.
So now you see Peter's dilemma with going to Cornelius' house.
Well, you're taking the cloak off of that story, and I haven't fully been able to remove that cloak.
Because,
oh, yes, going to his house.
Going to his house, because he would then be expected to eat what was provided. And even if, you know, Cornelius, understanding the Jewish sensitivities, did not offer unclean meats per se, they would still not be kosher.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They would, not only that, but, who knows, may have used fats from other things.
Lard.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So in removing that cloak from that, is it a parable? What? Vision.
It's a vision.
Vision. Mm-hmm. We've always been told, we've always understood, that that is saying it goes to all people, not just the Jews.
Right.
But with this understanding that we're trying to develop here,
It's both.
But could it also be referring
it's
to
both.
The food itself?
It's literal as well as metaphorical.
But we could understand why Jesus would use that metaphor to illustrate it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because that metaphor fits. And then you're saying it's both is...
Which we only take what we want. It doesn't mean that.
The part that I have a little bit of a hard time with saying is both. Because I'm not going out there to eat cooked clams. They stink. I'm not going to eat dragons or whatever else is in that thing.
It's icky snakes.
But the fact is, it's not a religious issue. I agree with that.
It is about hospitality.
I'm not going to eat a dead dog at your house just to be hospitable.
I've been in the Philippines, they're eating dead dogs right now.
For both Peter and for Paul, it is a radical change because they have to get over their cultural disgust with these things.
Yeah.
But in Petersburg, it's hard. People don't understand why I don't eat their crabs.
So to be fully effective in incarnational mission, you can't let those things
blockade your
become a barrier to receiving hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
because you can't just give hospitality. If you only give hospitality, then you're not participating.
And now you know
that is very critical.
Now you can see why Paul's discipline takes a lot of energy and effort.
But I still am defending.
So Jerry goes overboard.
And
eating meat,
I explain to the people that I go as far as I am emotionally capable of.
That he's a weak person.
And I think people understand that. But it goes both ways. It's not that I said, I draw the line and say absolutely no. But, I mean, if it's absolutely repulsive, it's ridiculous to try to eat it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, what you are saying is what was the word you used? To socialize with people. When you invite someone over to your house, you are being
hospitable.
When you're being hospitable, it has to go both ways. Hospitality has to go both ways. And that is so, so critical because when you go to...
You offer them something, but if they don't take it...
Yeah, so there's that kind of hospitality, but when a person is going out into a mission that is completely foreign, where the other party knows nothing about you, what Paul is saying is you have to first be in need of their hospitality.
Exactly, because we take our clothes, we take our food, we take our books, our literature, our culture, we take everything with us.
We've already got it all, we'll give some of it to you. We need nothing.
No, it's not for everyone. Some people cannot do it, but for those who want to, then it requires a tremendous amount of discipline.
And study. You know, to study their culture. And
yeah. And Christians tend to say, we've got a culture that's really good. We'll give it to you. You take some of our culture and become like us, and then you'll be...
Will you put some clothes on, I can look at you. You wouldn't fit in the culture.
The only thing I would add to what you're saying is, it's difficult to use a certain word. It's not something you artificially do. It's something you have to be.
Right, right.
And maybe the Catholic priests, what did they call them? Not, they were, well, Jesuits did it, but anyway, they seem to be a little bit more embedded where they go. I know that the Russian Orthodox up north, they go, it's a lifetime commitment.
But do you have your money and your own status? Did you have an aura about you, or do you, are you there to serve in their culture?
Are you there to become part of the culture?
See, I kind of like that better, because I get tired of everybody wanting to serve. What's wrong with, well, Paul, he went there and he made tents. What's wrong with living there and just living like as they live, make money, as they make money, and you don't have to live off of
that. A lot of times, a person's vocation brings them in contact with people.
Yeah, making tents for those ungodly sports.
Other people needed tents too. They lived. Did everybody live in tents?
No. So that brings us to today's section. Rhetoric is the introduction portion talks about the Old Testament sacraments as applied to Christians. The outer ring of this chiastic structure then will talk about destruction and examples. It's about warning and instruction applied to Christians. The inner ring mentions four sins of the Israelites, which alludes to the four issues in the Corinthian church. And then the very last verse is an aside by Paul, where he gives some words of encouragement. So it reads, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it." So first thoughts. First, let's talk about fairy tales. Fairy tales generally involve, not generally, but often involves, someone, some supernatural, some miraculous, some sort of fairy coming to the rescue.
We know little about these things. They know a lot about these things.
They live in these things.
Not just fairy tales, but, a lot of stories.
Hero stories.
Pretty much all stories.
Now, why is that?
Human nature.
The good and the bad and the other.
You know, if you wrote a book about everything that's good, there's nothing to read. Nobody to read. There's got to be a plot.
Humanity is uplifted by stories where the good overcomes the bad.
I want to focus on the role of the fairy.
The supernatural?
The supernatural, or the Dux Ex Machina in Greek.
What does that mean?
Greek plays. It's when, in Greek plays, when things get so convoluted that, you know, it you can't sort things out.
Disaster is coming in.
Something comes down from the heavens to basically a deity comes down.
Like
and,
a reset button.
Yeah.
to rescue.
Yeah.
Oh, better than just reset. You could get into the same mess again. He comes to leave you of the...
Why do stories require a supernatural intervention?
Yeah, why do so many stories involve interventions? Why...
Is it
case in point,
acknowledgement of
case in,
badness of the earth?
Well, case in point, it's, you know, just this past week, a huge typhoon hit the Philippines.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, out of that come so-called miracle stories of, you know, people whose lives were spared, buildings were spared, a statue of Jesus that was left standing all around his destruction.
An Adventist church that's standing in the midst of rubble.
I wondered if it was Adventist when I heard it on the radio.
There was a large Adventist church.
So,
surrounded by rubble. Yes.
And snares.
Yeah.
Engineering can explain the reasons, but why are humans so prone to attribute or to want divine intervention?
It gives us hope.
Maybe it's
a human
need to have.
Or is it an excuse?
Does it give us hope that even when we screw up or the world around us is falling to pieces, there's still, we expect divine intervention. We expect something to step in. And
no. Not yet. If you're asking a serious question, there might be a serious answer.
What's that?
Why do they want to know that the church stood miraculously? Because it takes away responsibility.
Yeah.
If I tell them it's because they had rebar in their construction and the other people weren't smart, it puts the responsibility back onto them.
People don't want to be responsible. People want to believe that whatever they're going through isn't their responsibility. It's
by God intervening,
and somebody else is going to intervene and get them out of it.
And by God intervening proves it was beyond their capability to start with.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Okay, so
you asked a question.
I did, and I've
seen some of that recently.
So back to the actual passage here. What do you think Paul is trying to communicate? You know, what does this have to do with food offered to idols, or with the other earlier parts of this essay, or even with earlier essays? Does it touch on any of those things? What applications do you think this passage has to the modern church? And again, what assumptions might we be reading into this passage?
Well, I think sometimes people think it's a human tendency to believe you have to be good enough to be rescued by the deity.
Yeah.
Or that it proves that they were good enough, or that they have the right beliefs.
Uh-huh.
When it happens.
Uh-huh. it's a if you've experienced a miracle, it's a validation that you were right all along.
Not that there was an engineer that knew what he was doing.
That's actually kind of offensive to the people who built the building.
Actually, it could be, yeah.
Or it could be...
the engineer, that's what I've heard.
Or the engineer could say,
I'm God.
Or you could say, duh.
Yeah.
I think I maybe get ahead of myself. It says...
Christian engineer might say, I've got to help God. And non-Christian engineer might say, I'm God.
And God may say, pooh, you guys don't forget it. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents. What's the story?
We'll get to it. Okay. We'll look at each of these.
That story's always, to me, been backwards.
It is kind of, isn't it?
Okay.
So the answer to your question,
of sin.
I'm not so sure Paul was writing all these downs as whatever. He was just referring to what they believed or what they lived or what they all knew about, because that's what they lived in.
Is he writing these all down because they apply directly to his point, or is he just summarizing their
ideologies?
Yeah.
In what ways have you heard this taught?
Heard what taught?
This passage.
Oh. The summary of the Israelites' presumption.
It's just clear. It's verse number 11. These things happened to them as examples.
Okay.
And therefore, we have no excuse to do them ourselves.
Let this all be a lesson to you, period. Don't do those things.
And therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall.
Follow the rules. And then take a second look to be sure you have followed the rules.
But then 13 is the one that gets screwed up.
Oh, I saw a commentary on verse 13 during the week, and I said, ooh, are we going to get to look at that? And just the sentence he said on Facebook, put it in the holding that light, and that's going to be exciting when we get to that part.
All right, so let's look at the intro section. It's the first four verses. The very first phrase, therefore, I do not want you to be unaware, brothers. You know, the four, it's that little connecting word. It is a progression of argument following the previous verse in chapter 9, where it read, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. So Paul will consider how disqualification happens and what it looks like.
So we're still about mission.
Paul will discuss what he intends by a lack of discipline, and the subject matter is still the fitness for mission. The moderns, again, tend to read into most of Paul's writings the idea of personal salvation, when that is frequently not the case. So, as a reminder, the issues in the Corinthian church were basically divisions. That's how the letter opened. It was about divisions. It was about the strong attempting to force their views on the weak. And both were leading to undermining the church's reputation and effectiveness and mission in the community. And so, Paul gave a parable about, you know, the planters and the builders, and through it he was trying to explain that the church, the new temple, is being destroyed from within. The word unaware, a better, more literal translation, is ignorant, because ignorant is the opposite of knowledgeable. It's the very issue at the beginning of this essay, number 3, where Paul quoted what the Corinthians were saying about themselves. We know that all of us possess knowledge. So the argument back there was on the nature of knowledge, and Paul argued that genuine knowledge comes from learning to love. Now, if anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know, but if anyone loves, he truly knows. What Paul is saying is that he will reveal something about genuine knowledge. And brothers, the usage implies brothers and sisters. It's not
okay.
So Paul is going to, in the subsequent verses now, Paul is going to discuss Hebrew history, but notice that he is speaking to the entire church, both Jews and Greeks. He doesn't say, now to you Jews, or now to you Greeks, or now to you Gentiles, but rather he's saying, now, brothers. Paul does not see Christianity as separate from Judaism. Rather, Christianity is the natural progression of Judaism. For Paul, Christianity, Judaism with Christ is genuine Judaism.
Mm-hmm. And a Christian Gentile would have the same history because he was adopted into it.
Right. So Gentile Christians had to have been familiar with major events of Hebrew history. They are adopted into the true Israel, and thus Israel's history is Christian history. Mm-hmm. So the next part of the introduction, where Paul brings out some of the Hebrew history, like the Red Sea, Moses, manna, the miraculous provisions of water, it's an example of Jewish midrash technique. It's their way of discussing and commenting on their texts. It's a little odd to our way of thinking. What Paul does is he transforms the Hebrew mythologies into Christian ones. And by the word mythology, I don't mean stories that are not true. By mythology, I'm using it in the technical, literal sense. The literary sense, where it means origin stories.
Stories that are part of the culture.
Stories that explain how things began, uh-huh. How they came about, and it often involves supernatural interventions. Uh-huh. So, the Exodus story, which is deliverance from slavery and oppression, that's turned into baptism. The wilderness experience, where the Israelites experienced God's abiding presence and provision, that is represented in Christianity by the Eucharist, or communion.
Uh-huh. Baptized by the crowd. Communion by men.
What Paul is doing is he's saying these patterns in history can be seen in now our times. These archetypal stories repeat themselves in history. She's also saying that some sacramental observances from the past can be transformed into new understandings without violating Christian beliefs and ethics. So this is partial identification. We don't have to reject everything. Jewish rabbinical tradition held that a miraculous source of water followed the Israelites around their wilderness wanderings. Was a rock. I think it was a camp.
It followed them.
Well, we kind of think that. We just say it never heard.
I thought it was the cloud that followed them.
Well, the cloud followed them too, but there was also a rock.
Everywhere they went, he hit a rock.
Rock providing water that followed them throughout, so they were never without water.
I thought they just came to another rock.
Well, that's how you
it wasn't like there was rocks everywhere.
So, kind of a side note here is that just because Jesus or the apostles state something as fact does not actually make it historically factual. I mean, it sounds, mm-hmm. no. It's tradition. Uh-huh. They may have been simply stating something that was accepted subjectively as fact.
Mm-hmm. Did they think that there was a literal rock that followed them?
Some of them probably did.
Jesus is a rock of my salvation. Does that make Jesus a rock?
No. Is it maybe sort of like the story of George Washington and the tree?
Tree, pulp, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The cherry tree.
I have the axe.
So,
you
know, one of the
things.
So, where this might apply, this little caution might apply, is Jesus took kind of the creation story to be a literal historical fact.
Yeah.
Well, just because Jesus did doesn't make it so, not necessarily.
Are you saying Jesus could have believed things that,
or taught things?
Jesus could. Yeah.
He didn't want to rip the whole rug out from under them,
right?
Without.
He didn't know.
That is entirely possible.
Yeah. He grew up in their culture.
He wasn't an engineer.
Oh my!
We have made God in our image. That's the problem. We think that God has to know everything,
Well, see, because Jesus was God, he had to know everything.
And if he stated something, it must be scientific fact. And maybe Jesus,
he had
when
to...
he lived on this earth, believed in something.
Well, see, and I've been kind of
aren't scientific fact.
Thinking about, this whole thing here. How much did Jesus really know? How much did Jesus learn? Because if Jesus knew everything, it wouldn't have mattered where or how he was born. Because his upbringing would have had no effect on his adulthood.
Oh, weird.
But the fact that Jesus was born to a common home and to specifically Mary and Joseph meant that they must have had something to... If incarnation is supposed to provide any value,
mm-hmm.
his earthly parents had to have something to offer to Jesus'
upbringing.
They had
to have some sort of input?
Yeah.
In his upbringing? Uh-huh. We tend to be taught that God raised him.
And what in Luke, Mary goes visit Elizabeth after she Mary learns she is pregnant with child.
Uh-huh.
No, part of that is Mary's song or the Magnificat, where if we accept it as Mary's views that she held as a teenager, probably Mary had very deep theological insights that most of the Jews didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So she was a highly... She may have been illiterate, but she was highly intelligent.
She may have been from an educated family.
And her understanding of race relations, ethnic relations, the relations between economic relations was extremely radical. Well, she believed in equality.
Well, she was a social justice activist.
Yeah.
Whoa!
And if that was the kind of home that Jesus grew up in,
oh my goodness.
You can see why.
He was raised by liberals.
You can see why maybe, he chose to be born there so that as an adult
he had more freedom.
He had
at home.
He would be able to teach. He would learn those things so that as an adult, as the adult Jesus, he would live and teach those concepts.
Oh my. Weird. That's just
let's see, I want to be born there. Our kids would have liked to have that choice.
Yeah. Yeah. So would ours.
You have the freedom to eat what you want and to preach what you want, but you better be careful where you say that.
So Jesus said that Mary was a liberal.
Yeah.
It's interesting thinking. It's fun thinking new things that we might not ever have thought before, and maybe didn't have the freedom to think before.
No, seriously though, if Jesus' childhood and first 30 years didn't matter, then it logically follows that his parents didn't matter.
What you're challenging is we have made God into the image we believe him to be. Therefore, he has to be all-knowing,
uh-huh.
all-powerful,
uh-huh.
present, everything.
Uh-huh.
We forget that Jesus gave all that up.
So, he's 100% God and 100% man. So we tried to still define that. We have never limited his godness that we have created. And what you're saying is maybe he gave up his godness that we think that he still had.
Or some, I don't know. Maybe, what did he give up? What did he retain?
I sympathize with what you're saying, because if God knew all the physics and science and chemistry and biology of the universe, it kind of defeats this whole thing.
I think that maybe Jesus did not understand all of physics the way we currently do.
I think he was a human being of his era.
Yeah, and why wouldn't then Jesus have grown up and learned not just knowledge, but how to relate to other people by what he observed and was taught. And so a choice of parents was extremely important. Anyway, so Paul, back to 1 Corinthians here, highlights two of the most important Christian sacraments, baptism and the Eucharist.
Uh-huh.
The Eucharist is going to come back, the communion is going to come back again in the next part of this essay. And the idea of food and drink brings this discussion back around to the question of food offered to idols.
Oh. Okay.
It has to do with sacraments. So let's go to the next set of verses. Verses 5 and 12. This is the outer ring now, where Paul explains that sacraments in and of themselves have no value in either initiating or maintaining a right relationship or righteousness with God. People can observe sacraments for the wrong reasons. They can do it to earn merit, to prove their spirituality, or to show how much better, stronger they are than others, the weak. It can be done for all sorts of wrong reasons. And what Paul, I think, is saying here is participation in sacraments for the wrong reasons can divide and harm rather than unite and restore. That's the purpose of the church, is to unite and restore. The purpose of Christian sacraments is to bring people together in unity and harmony. And the way Corinthians were practicing it, as we will see, not this week, but next time, is that the way they were practicing sacraments is that it was leading to divisions in the church. And in verse 12, those who think they have knowledge and think they are strong are in danger of falling. Arrogance is another one of those issues that permeates throughout this letter. Arrogance will destroy Christians and their communities. this goes back to 1 Corinthians, the third chapter, where Paul described the building and destroying of God's temple, the church. Paul writes that the Israelites failed to live up to God's purposes for them as witnesses for him. If Christians are not careful, then they too will fail to fulfill God's purposes for them. I think it's important to note that Paul is discussing the entirety of Israel, not specific individuals. Again, he's talking about a community. He's talking about the body. Likewise, so Paul is discussing the church community, not individual members. In other words, the concern of this passage is not salvation, but God's purposes for his community. The middle part, in the middle ring, now Paul can't issue blanket prohibitions. Now, he can't say, he can't rule that for Christians to avoid all cultic meals, because then he would also forbid the Eucharist, the communion. So Paul doesn't base his arguments on law. He doesn't issue law. But what he does is he gives examples of unethical behaviors. And in these verses, we see how Paul interprets Scripture. First, he sees the Scripture authors being inspired to record events of their time for the instruction of future generations. I mean, that's... Why do historians record history? Because they think that some of these things are important for future generations.
Yeah, that never works.
Paul also sees Scripture as pointing to a linear history with a definite endpoint. This is very different from most other mythologies. Now, in most other mythologies, time is circular. For the Jews, for the Hebrews, it has a beginning and it has an end. And so Paul sees himself and the Christians now as living in the time of the end.
Is that unique to Judaism?
The Islams.
Do they have time and end?
Yeah, they have an end.
So Middle East.
Did they see themselves as living in the
I don't know.
Okay. But as far as linear goes, Greeks?
Had a circular.
Romans?
They're Greeks. The most of the other have some kind of a cycle.
What about the Canaanites?
They would have been cyclical, based on the agricultural metaphor.
Okay. If you're cyclical, then time of end doesn't really make sense.
Right.
So we take offense of everybody's always living in time of the end. Maybe this time of the end is something different than we have perceived it to be because of the linear thinking.
For Jews, the Messiah is the delineation point between the past and the time of the end.
And everything in this universe rotates, pretty much. The circle, the Earth rotates around and around and around. But trains don't go in circles, trains go linearly.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying that the linear concept is more man-made? And
no.
No.
What I'm saying, what I'm going to say, is in a linear mind, by definition, you're always at the front end.
Uh-huh.
There is no future. Yeah. You always are at the future. Mm-hmm. Where it's circular, you're not.
Right. Well, see, in Jewish thought, the time before the Messiah was the present age. Uh-huh. And the time after the Messiah is the age to come, also known as the time of the end, the eschatological age. And so, for Paul, as someone who believed that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, then he was no longer living in the present age, but he had now entered into the end times.
But I know Dolores has a problem with our ultra concern about living in end times. I'm thinking that the historical thinking of living in the end times may have a different flavor than what we have grown up with.
Well, I think every person has their life to live, and when their life is over, that's a rather short amount of time, and the end is there for you. But maybe not the rest of the world.
Right, but you're saying that, you know, we've all grown up with, well, don't have any kids, don't get married, because we're in the end times.
I'm still hearing that from my sister. I said, is Kayla, does her younger brother
for,
have a baby make her want
to? No, for the ancients, for the Jews, the quantity of time is does not define in time.
And that's, I'm starting to get the feel
say,
like...
Say that again?
The quantity, the number of years doesn't determine the end time. The end time can go on a very long time.
But see...
Yeah, forever.
But some people live in this...
Anxiety.
Are already living in the end time in their mind. Because they're already bringing that in anxiety
because
into their life.
Because in the modern mindset, we think in very literal terms. So end must mean
now.
End.
Right. So that's what I'm trying to say, honey, is there may be, biblically, they may be saying something different than we are hearing when we hear the word. Now, when we say the end times, we're thinking of an atom bomb. And the time of trouble, and we're thinking the earth as we know it ceases. Now, as a Christian, Seventh-day Adventist Christian, we think a time of trouble. The atheists, they believe atomic warfare, and this world environmentally is going to implode on itself environmentally. Mm-hmm. When the Bible is talking about end times, what are they talking about? Either of those?
There may be a little of those, both of those things involved, but it really means the time when the kingdom of God has come. Not in its fullness, but yet the powers of evil have been destroyed, and Jesus is already reigning.
There is a difference here.
So the purpose of Paul's mission is to spread the kingdom, to bring more people under the reign of Christ that's already here.
When the Bible talks about the end times, from what kind of what I'm hearing, maybe we use the term, we live in the time of enlightenment.
Yeah. That could work.
When we remember what he said just before he left, love one another.
That does enlightenment, because you're saying we're living and we understand God because he came and told us.
And beginning to understand what's really important. That's enlightenment.
Then we get to the inner ring, a set of four. The rhetoric here is don't, as they did, and then some kind of a result. And Paul takes four examples from Hebrew history, and each also is a problem in Corinth. First is idolatry. This comes from a quote from Exodus 32, verse 6, in referring to the incident of the golden calf at Sinai, while Moses was up in the mountains. Paul chooses to focus on the eating and drinking portion of Exodus 32. Not the sacrifices that were made to the golden calf. Again, tying it to the cultic meal. They'll bring it home for the Corinthian church.
So is he saying, go ahead and eat the food, or don't eat the food? Or is he saying, don't be an idolater, whether or not you eat the food?
Well,
worship the...
So, It reads, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. The word play has sexual connotations. In Genesis 26, verse 8, Abimelech sees Isaac fondling, playing with Rebekah. In Genesis 21, verse 9, Sarah saw Ishmael playing with Isaac, which has traditionally been interpreted by the Jews to refer to some kind of molestation.
Weird. Yeah, never heard those sermons.
And then.
Well, who's Rebecca?
Isaac and Rebecca?
Isaac's wife?
So there's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's nothing wrong. It's just.
Abimelech just said in a bit there.
Well, remember, Isaac tried to.
Expressing the meaning of the word.
Tried to say, you know, when he went down into. When he went to Canaan, he tried to. Say, Rebecca was just his sister.
Oh, that was
Abraham.
Right.
Abraham did too, twice.
They both did it?
Isaac
they
did too.
They both did it.
Oh, yeah.
They both tried to save themselves by...
So who's Abimelech?
It's a title for a Canaanite warlord.
So that's what it is. Okay.
The guy he's... Yeah.
And so Abimelech brought Rebecca into his harem. But then later... saw Isaac fondling, as in sexually playing with Rebecca.
And
doing something a married man would do.
Yes. That expresses the meaning of the word, yes.
But Sarah is Isaac's mom, right?
Yes.
And Ishmael's mom. No.
Ishmael's and Abraham's
midwife. Yeah.
It was a
half-truth
he was trying to keep his own skin.
So maybe that really puts, Ishmael in a bad light. That's not a good story.
Yeah, I had not realized that was one of the issues.
Yeah.
So that puts Middle East conflict very bad.
Yeah. And it explains why Sarah's reaction.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sexual activities, especially among, you know, boys, is about power.
Is this when Sarah kicked her out?
Yeah. It's
That explains it. That explains it.
It wasn't just simple playing of two boys.
Tossing a ball back and forth, and she saw it, that wouldn't explain her reaction.
Well, I'm not going to get on the soapbox downtown and tell everybody this.
No. Because there are people who are descended from Ishmael who will be offended by that.
And those from the other side who take advantage.
Right, who take advantage of the accusation and renew. Yeah.
So, and when Paul quotes Exodus, he does it in Greek. The Greek word is paizo, which means play, literally, but it also often includes an erotic sense.
So how old was Ishmael?
Ishmael was probably in his teens.
And Isaac was just a baby. And the child grew and was weaned.
He would probably be about four.
And Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. So she said to Abraham, cast out this slave woman with her son.
It's not because she saw them playing together and was suddenly aware of his existence again. Renewed awareness of his existence.
But what you're saying
because
is...
Because they were friends.
Those actions were a power, a cultural...
Yeah.
So the world turns.
So Paul is, in his first example, he is trying to emphasize that participation in idolatry, even if one avoids actual idol worship, leads to ethical failures. Well, you can avoid sacrificing to the idols, but simply participating in the meals.
Oh, I see.
It means that, you know, you are being in a presence, you're in the presence of unethical actions.
So it sounds like he's saying don't eat.
Yeah.
Maybe don't go to that restaurant. They have other things going on there.
He's saying it's the activity. It's not the
food. But just a few verses ago, he said, sure, eat if you want to, don't eat if you...
The poor bought the food and took it home and ate it. These people are going to the party and participating in the ceremony, not just eating it.
Or whatever.
What Paul is going to come around to at the very, towards the end of this entire essay is that he's going to say, don't go to pagan temples.
Uh-huh.
As far as eating meat offered to idols that you buy at the market, well, it depends.
Depends on who you are.
Yeah.
Well,
and what you think about it.
Kind of sounds like to me, Moses wrote laws and Paul said, use your head.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Second example is immorality. This is in reference to Numbers chapter 25 when Israel partied with the Moabites.
It's like going to Keto's when there's going to be a stripper there.
Now, some have made issue of this because Paul writes that 23,000 were slain when in Numbers the count is 24,000.
Oh, no!
Shocking.
I was there and I counted exactly 0, 0, 0 right to the
yeah I'm sure. So
it was a lot. How about that?
This just simply follows from the previous part of idolatry and the immorality of the plane that is associated with it. No, it's not a general word against immorality, per se. It is in reference to the previous example. The third example is putting Christ to the test. This is reference to Numbers 21, when Israel spoke out against Moses and God because they only had manna to eat. Well, they're complaining about their restrictions on food.
And these guys are...
grumbling about the same sort of thing. So some in Corinth, they were challenging accepted Christian traditions that were given to them, and they were also challenging Paul's authority to communicate these matters to them. And so they were testing Christ by separating sacraments from ethics.
By practicing them in immoral ways.
I don't know what that means. Separating sacraments from ethics.
Did you say that next time we're going to talk about how the sacraments were being...
Some in Corinth were thinking that... Well, I think we'll come to it. We'll come to it in just a little bit here. So... The fourth example is grumbling, and this ties in with the third one. You know, putting Christ to test and grumbling, they go together just as the first two went together. This one is in reference to Numbers chapter 14 or Numbers 16. Numbers 14 is when the 12 spies returned and the people grumbled. Well, they grumbled that, God's leading them into certain death.
Okay.
Numbers 16, this is the incident with Korah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, Paul is writing about some in Corinth grumbling about many things. Basically, this entire first epistle has to do with at least some in the Corinthian church grumbling about various things. So what is what is the real problem? The underlying problem involves idolatry, and this is something that we talked about when we were going through Romans. This is an entry from the commentary for Romans 3, chapter 3, verse 9. And here, Jews thought of idolatry as a matter of worshiping the wrong gods, and therefore something that only Gentiles could do. Paul thought more deeply on the matter. He saw that idolatry was a disease of human freedom. found as widely among Jews as among Gentiles. Idolatry begins where faith begins, and the perception of human existence is contingent and needy. But whereas faith accepts such contingency as also a gift from a loving creator from whom both existence and worth derive, idolatry refuses a dependent relationship on God. It seeks to establish one's own existence and worth apart from the claim of God by effort and striving or works of one's own. So what may be happening in the Corinthian church is something that probably happens, you know, in modern Christianity as well. It's the compartmentalization of life into sacred and secular. Now, that can be a form of idolatry. It's a way of justifying one's self-serving behaviors. Now, I can do whatever I want in the secular realm as long as I'm faithful in the sacred realm. So that goes to the idea of separating sacraments from ethics. That, you know, as long as I keep the sacraments, ethics doesn't matter.
Got it. So as long as you keep the sacraments, as long as you observe communion and baptism and all of that, what you do to other people doesn't matter. Observing ethical behavior in your daily life doesn't matter.
Yes, some in Corinth thought they could do as they pleased as long as they observed the Christian sacraments and avoided the pagan ones. So, you know, reasoning possibly along the lines, we know that as long as we don't sacrifice to idols, we can participate in cultic pagan meals because, well, idols aren't real. Or they may have had some magical concepts of the Eucharist, that the ritual conferred some kind of immunity against being touched by pagan influence. This is a quote from a commentary. The nature of this argument strongly suggests that those who think they stand, found in verse 12, do so on the basis of a somewhat magical view of the sacraments. Otherwise, one can scarcely make sense of the present paragraph. Therefore, their argument with Paul most likely included some reference to their own security through the sacraments, which so identified them as Christians that attendance at the idol temples was immaterial since those gods did not exist.
I've observed the sacraments, so the other things I do don't matter.
So can Christians today hold to magical views of church traditions?
Sometimes, yes.
Now, traditions both promote participation in some things, you know, such as, well, church attendance is one. Communion is another, baptism. But church traditions also encourage avoidance of other things. Can traditions be interpreted magically?
I personally don't see the value of the washing of the feet and the drinking of the wine. To me, I just see confusion.
You don't see the value in the sacraments or the value in the magical interpretation. The sacraments themselves, you don't see the value in them because it leads to the magical interpretation.
To me, it's a tradition that has gone on and people are doing it, but I don't get it.
But what does it really do to you?
Part of it is simply it's an illustration of doing something together.
Uh-huh.
That's the value.
And an illustration of the acceptance of Jesus and his sacrifice.
But if we all agree that 3 o'clock we're going to go on to walk out to the waterfalls, I see a lot more value in that. But to do this together, it's a tradition. Maybe if it's looked at as, you know, every Christmas Eve we have a tradition of eating toast and jam. Yeah. But everybody's, maybe it's the...
But it's supposed to be a humbling experience. I mean, you think of Jesus, you're supposed to be thinking of Jesus, God.
Well, the foot washing is a very little observed tradition.
Yeah, except in the Adventist Church.
Except in the Adventist Church, some a few other minor denominations, and the Pope on...
Oh, we're following him?
On, is it Maundy Thursday?
That he washes somebody's feet?
Okay.
Yeah. He washes 12.
Oh, he washes 12 people's feet. I remember reading...
All the disciples were too good, and so no one wanted to lower themselves to do that, so Jesus did it.
No, that's the traditional interpretation.
Oh.
And that may be part of it, but I wrote a series.
You wrote a series, or Ken Bailey wrote
it? No, I wrote a series on what I saw in that story.
Okay.
It has to do with a radical destruction of the concept of hierarchical authority.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. It's far more than just humbling oneself.
Uh-huh. And if we would, in context, do that periodically through our meetings, people would learn that. But to follow these rituals, I think we're just creating...
You're blind to what it was supposed to be.
Well, a magical ritual.
The bread and wine...
And a requirement.
When a person thinks about it, it ties the participants all back to the Last Supper. It is a way of participating in something that all Christians have participated in.
Do you believe Jesus said, "This do in remembrance of me"?
Probably.
Like, I'm not going to drink anymore till I come again. But you can do it and remember this time we had special.
Well, actually, Jesus didn't say until I come again. It was until
we drink together or something like that.
It has to do with the next stage.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so...
Right now is before my death. Uh-huh. After my death, is that the next age?
A new age will have come.
When he has conquered evil, uh-huh, and the kingdom has come.
Uh-huh. Huh.
What Paul is writing here, again, is idolatry and faith are mutually exclusive. That participation in idolatry leads to ethical failures. And Paul's real issue is not with food. But Paul's real issue is with the arrogant, self-serving attitudes of some in Corinth who wish to justify their actions with faulty theologies.
So I have a sneaking notion that we have all grown up with this saved by faith versus saved by works. And Paul's talking about saved by works is idolatry, saved by faith is Christianity.
Maybe.
So Paul writes this because he wants Paul's readers to identify with ancient Israel and its sacraments. But they were to avoid the ethical failings that occurred during the Exodus in spite of those great sacraments. So rituals, tradition and rituals define a community. It's part of what community is.
Like Yobatsu.
Yeah, it's... Well, for your family, for your community, there are certain things that you repeat.
Right.
And it's helpful in understanding your place in history.
And the sacraments.
The point of sacraments is to remind you who you are.
Uh-huh.
No, it confers no other value.
Not to create who you are, not to transform you into something, but to remind you of it. That makes sense. To remind you who you are,
Paul wants Christians to be reminded that we are part of this great tradition that stretches all the way back to Abraham, to Moses.
When I say idolatry, I think of licentiousness.
Licentiousness?
Yeah. I think of those sexual parties you're talking about.
Pagan cultic parties?
Cultic parties.
Orgies.
Orgies. Go on and on. But what you're saying is, and so to me, it looks like people out there frolicking, just playing around. But what you're saying is idolatry is trying to appease your gods through your works to make the God happy enough to save you.
Well, not just that. It's making yourself God, making your own desires, putting priority on your own desires over the greater good of others.
Yeah.
Basically saying, I'm independent. I don't need anything else. I don't need you.
It's all about me.
I don't need God.
It's all about me.
And faith is?
Faith is saying, I'm not enough by myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's just as bad if you are doing the exterior looking all the right things, but you're not happy about it. You have a bad attitude. It's just as bad.
Right, the reason.
I want to do just as I please, but I can't. I have to serve everybody.
Or you go through all the motions in order to gain power over someone else. I mean, that's just as much idolatry.
So you can be doing the right things for the wrong reasons, and it's just as much idolatry as doing all the wrong things, so...
Yep.
Have at it.
Yep. Which brings us to the aside. Readers of Paul here might be wondering if the Hebrews, with all their privileges and sacraments given by God, could not please God, what are our chances? Now, if there's so many ways to go wrong, what are our chances? So Paul offers words of encouragement. The context is how to escape temptation to idolatry. This text is not a blanket promise that Christians won't be subjected to any circumstance beyond what they are able to handle.
But we've so often used it that way.
Yeah.
Well, just to back up. I thought we were talking about missions.
We are.
Well, you all of a sudden use this word to please God, and I thought we could please God without having being a missionary.
It is about mission, but Paul, I think, does speak to a somewhat more general topic of effectiveness of the church, because mission is for everyone. Now, mission doesn't look the same for every person, but mission is the purpose for the reason Christians live.
It's, yeah, right, to serve each other. If you're not serving each other, then okay.
So, from this commentary, it reads, dealt with in isolation from the passage in which it occurs, this verse, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, is sometimes turned into a quasi-theological, philosophical explanation of human suffering, evil, and divine will. The statement is elaborate and does perhaps invite such exposition and speculation. Yet one must see that this verse is not an isolated philosophical statement that purports to delineate intricate facets of life. Paul speaks to the Corinthians in context. They are arrogant, overly self-confident, believing themselves to be standing firm. But Paul says, watch out. The Corinthians are not above the unpleasant complications of normal human existence, and facing that fact, they have one hope, the faithfulness of God. God is trustworthy, and even if the situation seems impossible, nothing is beyond God's power and grace. When the Corinthians confront times of trouble, they should not deny their susceptibility to temptation or trust their own super spirituality to see them through. Rather, they need to remember to know and to act on the one ultimate assurance that is their real security, God is faithful. The tendency to overread this verse is a temptation within itself. But despite the mysterious matters that it raises, the plain sense of the verse is a call to recognize and to trust God. And notice the last phrase of this verse 13, "But with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it." So the promise is that God's faithfulness to his people is such that they need not succumb to the temptation of idolatry. What it doesn't promise, that God will change circumstances to end the temptation. What it does say, Christians will continue to endure and bear the tension in the present life of making difficult choices about how to live in the world in order to be effective in mission, but to not be of the world, to remain effective in mission. So this harkens back to the discipline Paul wrote earlier. Christians are always going to have to live with the ambiguity and the tension that involves being effective in mission. The temptation is always going to be there to succumb to basically relying on self. Relying on religion rather than on God.
That's fine.
People prefer magical religions.
Uh-huh.
You know, we want religions that promise miraculous deliverance. We want religions that promise that, you know, if you follow these certain steps, all will be well.
You'll never face anything really bad.
We want a fairy tale religion.
Uh-huh.
And Paul here in verse 13 is saying Christianity isn't like that. You will be tempted, but you will be able to bear it, and you will be able to continue to endure it.
Are you ready for my question?
Sure.
No temptation is a pretty broad statement.
But it is in the context of the verses that came.
So
in regards
no
to idolatry.
In regards to being a missionary.
These struggles that you're facing are not more than you can bear. You can deal with this situation.
So I there's two or three things here. One is, if you limit no temptation to context of this chapter, then it's in regards to you were called to be a missionary and you're going to have difficulties as a missionary, but it's in that context.
It's in that context, and even more specifically, it's in the context of basically reliance on sacraments.
So the fact that, okay, let's put that aside for a minute. The words that I get hung up on is, he will also provide, you know, that he is capital, God will also, which means if God is going to provide the way out, he also means God provided the way in. Therefore, God is the one that did the tempting.
That's reading too much.
Well, that's what I've always heard.
Mm-hmm.
But
God tempts us?
That's not the text.
No.
No, it says God is faithful.
No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. There's nothing about the agency or
so
the origin.
With the temptation, he will also provide. So, okay, I'm just telling you where I've always heard this. Now, but what
you're telling
me, he's got
his ears hooked on that word.
What you're telling me is these temptations are in regards to mission and taking offense of this and that and the other thing. It's not in regards to, well, God took your baby away and He gave you, he will give you the strength
to get over it.
To get over it.
No.
It's not talking about that.
It's not talking about general troubles.
Oh, they. Now, that is a proposed thing that
it's not talking about what?
General troubles and trials.
That's the
point. But it is purported to be your whole life.
It is
purported
to be that you will never.
You may be actually. When it comes to trials and general temptations, you may be tempted beyond what your ability.
So there, it's okay if you're mentally skewed and need mental help because you were pushed over the edge. It you aren't making God seem null and void that He didn't. He gave you. You maybe had more on your plate than you could handle.
People who are mentally.
Yeah.
This verse is used in all sorts of terrible ways.
I've never heard that one. But the point is...
You'll never be tempted by it beyond what you can handle, so just deal with it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's your problem.
Get over it. God promised. You can. Buck up.
You can...
God gave you this your body. It's okay. But, on the other hand, God sent the 77 out as missionaries, and in His commission and sending them out, he said, as your missionaries out there, there's no temptation as over here.
Right.
You're saying this is in context. That makes a lot of sense.
That makes ever so much more sense, yeah. Then, in general, you'll never face anything.
So the first part of 13 is saying, there's nothing new under the sun. God is faithful. He will not put you through more than you can handle.
But he's talking to missionaries.
He'll.
And he's talking about this particular situation.
He's talking about the situation of how can I be effective in mission?
Uh-huh.
How can I become weak?
And he's not talking about
how can I meld into the community.
Or temptation you can't handle. He's talking about. Yeah.
He's not talking about general life. The wickedness of life.
Yeah. Life happens. Life is bad sometimes.
But that
bad stuff happens.
But I have heard, and that's what I've always
heard. So this verse can be used in a very magical way.
Right.
Yes.
It's magic. I think I can.
I have never heard this too much for myself. That's always on a third party.
Yeah. You will be able to deal with
it. But people do use it for themselves in private as well.
In a third party way.
No, in a one person way.
People do also.
They beat themselves up with that.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Right, right. I should be able to do this.
Right.
Because God said, I'll be okay.
Like Patty has above her desk, I can do all things. Through Christ, which strengthens me. Maybe.
That's another talk. That's, yeah.
Maybe.
The context of that is being content. It's not about all things.
It's not about strength. It's not about
It's
power.
About being content, whatever your circumstances may be.
Oh, how different.
God didn't give you the circumstance, but He did give you the ability to be content in the circumstances.
Yeah, you can be, you have access to strength so that you can be content whatever is happening.
Bold at you.
I just wish you would have taken the word. He will also. Those three words to me are inappropriate.
Maybe they weren't there.
That's true. For all temptations, He will provide. Now that makes sense to me.
See, I think it was, I can't remember who exactly it was, but I think it was N.T. Wright, who...
Opposed to N.T. Wrong.
who said recently that the context of a verse is not just the chapter.
It's culture.
It's the book.
Uh-huh. It's the book and the
culture. Here, verse, and when you put them all together, you get a hole.
A hole?
Yeah.
A hole in the ground.
H-O-L-E.
And we've seen this morning, today, how the entire letter of Corinthians, to what we've read so far, informs kind of our reading of this small section.
Well, the point that I have concluded, and it's only good because of your deal, is we grew up with a verse here, there a verse, and you put it together and you end up with a doctrine that is holistic and it stands, it holds water. But when we start thinking about it, all of those books were written by
different men. People for different purposes in different times and places.
Exactly. So how could they know that someone's going to come together 2,000 years later?
Someone else is going to write this sentence over here, and someone else is going to write that sentence.
Well, and so that's based on the theology of inspiration.
I didn't say that.
To a person who believes that the Bible was designed and written by God,
right,
then the entire thing is a singular. It is a sort of a magical view of the Bible.
God created the whole thing with the knowledge of that we would be reading it, so he created it as a puzzle, and all the pieces fit together with all the other pieces, even though they were written thousands of years apart. We can take them in our culture and take this one here and this one here and put them together and apply it to our culture, and it will fit. And I won't believe that.
So studying these books in context with the book, what did the author intend to say? What did the audience, what was it the audience, the author intended to hear
in
the culture? When you put all that and limit it to that, it really works.
It makes more sense.
No temptation has overtaken you. I'm talking to six people that I'm sending out on a special mission. So obviously that temptation is in regards to the mission that I'm sending them out on. And I will provide you abilities to get out if you get stuck. Here's a cell phone. Have a problem.
Yep. So the final thing is, how much can I get away with? That's the wrong question. That's what the Corinthians wanted to know.
Yeah, that's what they were asking.
Paul's response is to ask them, what does it look like to be faithful to God and His community?
It's like going to school and wanting to skip out on all the lessons. Well, what's the point of going to school?
Well, Paul's basically saying, remember your history. No, it's not about rituals and traditions, but it's about ethics. How do you relate? How do you how do you interact with one another? And the sacraments are only valuable in that they remind people of those of proper interactions.